So let's take that moment to let our minds settle from whatever's been on them. Settling into an awareness of our body, on our seat, in our space, in our cyberspace, in this present moment of awareness. All senses open, thoughts coming and going, just letting everything settle. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru, four continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. And before we put our prayer sheets away, I want to revisit the Refuge in Bodhicitta prayer and do it one more time with sort of full awareness that this is our topic that we're embarking upon. The meaning of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which is the basis then for both aspiration and action bodhicitta. So this prayer encompasses all of that. So let's do it again in case we did it in a little bit of a rote way the first three times. Let's do it one more time and really, really bring the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha to mind and our aspirations. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. Four Dharmas of Gampopa. Dharam sam shantam chelo chasu drawer zinji lapdu sol chalam du drawer zinji lapdu sol am drupa sower zinji lapdu sol drupa yishisu charwar zinji lapdu sol. I pray for blessing, may my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing, may the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing, may the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing, may confusion arise as wisdom. And from the aspiration to excellent conduct. Lai ke dang lu dan nu jin ke chulun da da mi ke nam dang roa kunji ra ke ji tam par tam che ke du da ki chit ten to. In the tongues of nagas, yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And the reminder for arousing bodhicitta, again, this is our topic, this is the main topic of the book, is how to do this, how to arouse aspiration bodhicitta, the first sentence, and engagement or action bodhicitta, the second sentence. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So now we're going to do a relatively short meditation today. I'm hoping to leave room for discussion at the end of the class today. So we'll just do sort of an abbreviated meditation, Two Wings of Awakening. Everything will be in there. So bring our minds back to rest, just letting ourselves settle. And this is something we can do repeatedly throughout the day. It needs can be refreshed anytime. And then bringing to mind briefly each of the four reminders, the precious human existence, fully appreciating that in this moment, letting it motivate us to practice. Second, impermanence and death, even more motivation to practice, and especially to practice right now, because we don't know how long we have this opportunity. Third, karma, cause and result. We need to watch all of our actions, make sure we're engaging in positive actions that take us toward awakening, avoiding negative actions that take us away from awakening, and engaging in practice which liberates us from samsara. And then the suffering of samsara. Even what we feel is pleasure is really suffering. So instead of simply practicing in order to improve our situation in this life, we need to practice in order to liberate ourselves and all others from the whole thing. Looking at all experience as a dream. Just letting it fade a bit from solidity and sharpness. Turning inward to examine the nature of unborn awareness, looking at the mind itself, looking at our awareness itself. Does it have a shape or color? Is it located somewhere? Just looking, seeing, resting. Let even the remedy release naturally. Whatever we saw when we looked at mind, we let go of any conceptuality about that, and that brings us into resting in the essence, the basis of everything, the nature of our mind, our own Buddha nature. Each time conceptuality arises again, each time we get caught up in a thought, an emotion, a perception, we just gently let go of it. Come back to resting in a state in which our mind is completely open to it. We're looking at its nature in a very relaxed way, not worrying about whether we see the nature or not, but just resting in it. And within this resting in the nature, within this awareness of awareness, we practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. Pick any object for your taking and sending. Whoever you're taking and sending for, expand your field to include all beings who are having the same kind of suffering as that person or persons or animals. Including people that you love, people you feel neutral about, and if possible, people that you don't have warm feelings toward. Not necessarily having to see individuals, but just aspiring to include them, whoever they may be. in this life, past lives and future lives. And then all sentient beings in all six realms, whatever kind of suffering they may have, whatever our relationship with them, breathing in their suffering, letting it dissolve into our vast Buddha nature and breathing out whatever they need. And now, thinking that through this practice, all beings in all six realms of existence, people we love, people we hate, people who are in between, we're all completely free from suffering, completely filled with happiness, and completely awakened. And letting go of all visualization and conceptuality, return to resting in the essence, the basis of everything, whether it's just open awareness, shine, or resting in the nature of mind, or whether we know or not which it is, just letting our minds rest. And now coming back to study and contemplation mode at your own speed. Anybody have any questions or observations before we begin? All right, we're going to begin with a brief review of the points of refuge that we've covered so far. We're going to do it as one of my favorite things, and probably nobody else's favorite thing, a silent pop quiz, meaning nobody has to answer, but I'm just going to allow a moment as I mention each point to see if you have retained it. And if not, these are the important points from refuge, so you might want to go back and review as part of your reading this week. So the first point of refuge was the 12 topics, of which this chapter is just the first topic. The chapter on refuge is just the first topic. It is the basis of it's actually bodhicitta, the 12 points of bodhicitta, because we're starting the bodhicitta 12 chapters now, and refuge is the basis of that, and that's the first topic. So all of this that we studied last week and are studying this week, it all falls within the first of the 12 topics. So the first point under refuge was that refuge is one component of the basis for bodhicitta. There are four components. Do we remember the others? What four things do we need in order to truly engender bodhicitta? So first we have to belong to the Mahayana family, and that's from chapter one on Buddha nature, the five different types of connection with Buddha nature. We need to be the final one, Mahayana. We need to take refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which is what this chapter is about. According to Gampopa, we need to hold any level of pratimoksha vow, of personal liberation vows, and we'll talk about that today when we get to it in Gampopa. And Ringu Tulku says it differently. He says you need either refuge or a pratimoksha vow, but that's a little bit in conflict with what Gampopa says, so I'm not sure what that means, but we will talk about that later in the class. And the fourth thing that we need is aspiration bodhicitta, which is based on the refuge vow. So the second point in the refuge chapter was who we take refuge in. And so he listed a couple of of sources that are not good sources of refuge. So why are the worldly gods, including nature spirits, why are they not effective sources of refuge? Because they're not free from samsara themselves. That is the seventh verse of the 37 practices. Why are our parents and loved ones and people in our lives, why are they not a source of refuge? First, they're not reliable refuge because they have other concerns. They're not necessarily always worried about protecting us. And then they are also not free from samsara. They haven't transcended fear and they still suffer. So someone who's still suffering is not a good source of refuge because they can't lead us out of suffering. So here's the easy one. What are the three effective sources of refuge? We'll just all list them in our own minds. that is the Buddha as our example, the Dharma as the way to attain what the Buddha attained, attain Buddhahood, and the Sangha as our guides and supports on that journey. All right, this one should also be easy after last week's discussion. Which of these three sources of refuge is the only ultimate refuge? And I will say people have different ideas about this when they haven't just read Gampopa. I've heard arguments for the others being the primary source of refuge, but Gampopa is very clear that there's only one ultimate refuge. And that is the Buddha, because the others are temporary. You only need the Dharma until you get to Buddhahood. The Sangha is not itself completely free from fear and must still take refuge themselves. They're not fully realized, otherwise they would fall into the Buddha category. So in that case, let's see if we remember this. In that case, why are there three refuges? Why are we encouraged by Gampopa to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha if only the Buddha is the true ultimate refuge? And he says, it's because the Dharma and Sangha, the Buddha is the real refuge, the ultimate refuge, but the Dharma and Sangha are the methods, the support for attaining Buddhahood. And he also further says that the one refuge, the Buddha, is presented as three. It's broken down into three parts or three aspects, the teacher, which is the Buddha, the teaching, which is the Dharma, and those who are in training, which is the Sangha. And the reason for this is in order to help beings who have different propensities. And we're going to segue right into Gampopa and pick up where we left off, because he explains that a little bit, which I think is really interesting. And it falls in the category of technical information and not something that you have to remember, but it's still interesting. And it is on page 101, I think. Yes. So we're in the actual Ornament of Precious Liberation, or Jewel Ornament, if you have that version. So a good review near the top of page 101. This is right after he talks about the Buddha as the only ultimate source of refuge. So he lists 9 different topics under refuge, all of which are covered in this chapter because this is the refuge chapter. 9 topics, categories, basis, source, duration. Did I miss what I was gonna, no. Where is that? I see, wait a minute. No, this is review and it's not where we need to be. But anyway, categories, basis, source, duration, motivation, ceremony, function, instruction, and benefits. So we have covered actually the first categories, the first 3 topics here. The basis, the categories, and the categories, it's interesting, middle of page 101, there are 2 different categories of refuge, general and particular. And this was confusing for me the first few times I've read this, because it's like he doesn't explain that. But it turns out that those 2 categories apply to each of the subsequent topics. If you notice, each topic is divided into a general and a particular. So I think that's what it's referring to here. And then we covered the basis and the source, and you can review those. We just did review those. So we're actually at the bottom of page 103 now. And I'm not going to read the paragraph, which is about why the three refuges are why the one refuge is really presented as three refuges. But basically, it divides up into the three vehicles. And again, this is harking back to the Buddha Nature chapter and the five families or types or the five degrees of manifestation of Buddha Nature. He says that the Bodhisattva or Mahayana level has the capacity to relate mainly to the Buddha. They relate, when you're on the Bodhisattva path, you're mainly relating to the Buddha because you're trying to achieve that. The Dharma is sort of the main refuge of the solitary realizer, the Pracheka Buddha. And the Sangha is the main refuge of the hearers, or the Shravaka Buddhas. So I thought that was interesting. It's just by way of, he said that, and I thought it was interesting. So we're not going to go into that any deeper. But just it's sort of shoring up this idea that there's no conflict between the one ultimate refuge and the three ways that refuge is presented, because it just appeals to different types of minds, different, you know, sort of ways of being on the path. Okay, we did that. Okay, so then we're on page 104, and we're going to sort of zip through the rest of the points. The rest of the 9 points of refuge, we've covered three. So there's four more. We're going to start with point four. And we will be looking at Ringu Tulku a little bit from time to time today too. So fourth, there are two possible durations of refuge. The general, and here's the categories, the general and the special, or general in particular. The general duration is to take refuge from the time of the ceremony onward for as long as one lives. In short, taking refuge just for this lifetime. The special motivation special duration is to take refuge from that time onward until the essence enlightenment is attained. And that's what we're encouraged to do when we take refuge formally. We take refuge for all lifetimes. So that's the fourth topic under refuge. Fifth thing to be discussed about refuge is there are two possible motivations. The general motivation is to consider personal suffering unbearable, and that is verse 8 of the 37 practices. You avoid all harm to others. That's the eighth practice, because if you harm others, you end up in the lower realms. It increases your suffering, and so you're trying to escape suffering. That's the general motivation for taking refuge. The special motivation is to consider others' sufferings unbearable. And that's verse 9 of the 37 practices. Okay, so the next topic, the sixth topic under refuge, is ceremony. And we are going to look at Ringu Tulku for this one, but I'm just going to read this first sentence. Sixth, there are two forms of ceremony, general and special. Most of us have taken refuge formally, so we know the routine. We're going to look at page 74 in Ringu Tulku, and he's going to just explain a little bit about the ceremony in sort of friendlier terms, or, you know, more concise terms than Gampopa. Whoops. Is it? Right. 74, middle of the page, the refuge ceremony. So there's a few really important observations in here. Whether you've taken refuge or haven't taken refuge, it's a good reminder if you have taken refuge. The refuge ceremony formally marks the moment when one becomes a Buddhist. It is about choosing a direction and a path for oneself. Traditionally, one takes refuge with a lama, but it is also possible to do it in front of an image of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. So that's comforting. I think if you haven't taken refuge, and I've certainly advised people about this when they're not in a position to actually go and take refuge with a lama, then they can take an interim refuge. And then you still aspire to take refuge as soon as you can to be officially on the path. But
Rinpoche Tulku says we can also do it ourselves if we don't have access to a lama. So in front of an image of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, we first, or to a person if we're with, you know, if we're taking an official ceremony with a lama, we first make three prostrations to the person with whom we are about to take refuge. The prostrations are the formal request to take refuge. The Buddha forbade any of his followers to give refuge, or for that matter, to give any precepts or teachings without being specifically asked. This is like the non-proselytizing aspect of Buddhism. We don't try to turn people into Buddhists, as the Dalai Lama was asked if he was here to proselytize. This was like an interview back in like the 70s on TV that I saw. And he said, "You mean make more Buddhists? That's not nice." So we wait for people to have that wish themselves. And then when we're requested, we do it. So, but that comes from the Buddha. We're not allowed to teach or to give refuge unless specifically asked. And then thereafter, following the teacher, we repeat the refuge prayer three times. That is the refuge ceremony. In the Tibetan system, we usually get a new name to denote that we have started a new way of life. And the lama, I found this interesting because I always forget why the hair is cut. And there's also more than one explanation. But the lama also cuts a little piece of our hair to represent that we make the highest offering to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. As hair grows on the highest part of the body, it's usually from the crown of the head, this represents a significant offering. In the course of this ceremony, one makes many different vows. One makes different vows relating to the three objects of refuge, three principal vows, three vows linked to positive actions, and three vows linked to negative actions. And we're actually going to go back. You can continue to look at Rinpoche Tulku if you have that, because it's the same information said differently. But this I'm going to read from Ornament of Precious Liberation. And his ceremony explanation takes a few pages, so we're now on page 106. Okay, so actually that's 8, but we haven't done 7 yet. So the 7th topic concerning the function of refuge, the general refuge, so that's taking refuge to end your own suffering. The general refuge protects from all harms, from falling into the lower states, from ineffective courses of action, and from false beliefs about the self based on the aggregates, literally the perishable collection. That's another name for it. Used to be called, the teacher I learned this from called it the perishable base, the aggregates. The particular refuge, that's refuge because you can't bear the suffering of other beings. The particular refuge also protects from the lower realms, the lower paths. So now we're at the point where we left off in Rinpoche Tulku. Like, when you take the vow of refuge, what are you committing to? So these are the instructions. And there's a lot of instructions, but they're all pretty obvious, and they're all things most of us have heard before. But again, it's really good to refresh this every once in a while, so we can be alert. So 8th. The instructions concerning refuge are 9-fold. 3 common instructions, 3 particular instructions, and 3 specific instructions. And Rinpoche Tulku has those same 3 lists, slightly different names. So the 3 instructions common to all 3 refuges are, first, to strive at all times to make offerings to the 3 precious refuges, at least dedicating the first mouthful of food when eating. I forget to do that sometimes. I do the prayer. But, you know, I forget kind of the meaning of the prayer. You're actually offering the first of the food to the 3 refuges, and also in our prayer to Chenrezig. And also, you know, I remember hearing from Lama Narla Rinpoche, you also, if you buy new clothes, then you sort of offer that. Anything that new that you buy a new house, you buy new clothes, you think of the refuges and you think you're offering it to them. And then you get to enjoy it, but you've also offered it. It just helps you remember that the 3 jewels are there for you. So that's the first one, to strive at all times to make offerings. Second one is to never abandon the 3 refuges, 3 precious refuges, even should this cost life itself or involve personal loss. And so this is something that we aren't likely necessarily to encounter in our lives, but in the 1950s, you know, in the Cultural Revolution, many Tibetan lamas were in this situation, ordered to give up their Buddhism, their belief in Buddhism, their refuges, or they would lose their lives, or they would be thrown in prison, and many lost their lives and were thrown into prison. And then third of the three common refuges, three common instructions are to develop the habit of repeatedly calling to mind the qualities of these three most precious things and taking refuge in them. And so I think that that's really key one, is just to remember them throughout the day. And that's an antidote to what we talked about last week. What do we take refuge in when we encounter an obstacle or we become stressed? And often the first thing we think of is not the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's whatever will comfort us in that moment. And so if we could replace that habit, or just start to work on replacing that habit, or even after the fact, remember, the real refuge, the real thing that can help me, the real thing that can protect me is the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I think it really helps. So that's the three common instructions. The three particular instructions are, once you've taken refuge in the Buddhas, refuge need no longer be taken in any other divinity, is the way that Ken says it here. And Rinpoche Tukwu says in any lesser refuges. So again, that covers the territory we just talked about. No more refuge in worldly gods, no more refuge in ice cream, no more refuge in TV. We don't need to take refuge in anything less than the Buddha. The second of the three particular instructions is, having taken refuge in the Dharma, harm should no longer be done to any sentient being. We need to refrain from all harm and be really, really aware of our actions and their impacts. Having taken refuge in the Sangha, trust should not be placed in the misguided. And misguided is a translation of, here the Sanskrit is given, tirtika. I forget what it's called in Tibetan, but we struggled for many, many years to understand what that meant. Who are these? And it was translated as heretics. And Ken explains he prefers the term misguided. It just means people who are on a path that does not, that contradicts like the basic tenets of Buddhism. And so here it would have referred to other schools of philosophy, largely Hindu, which is nothing against Hinduism. It's just that the Buddha had a different idea. So here we're being, encouraged. If we're going to take the Buddha as our refuge, then we need to follow the Buddha's teachings and the teachings of the Sangha. And the way Rinpoche Tukwu expresses this one is to avoid negative influences and bad companions, which is verse 5 of the 37 practices. And the reasons for avoiding them are given in that verse. All right, so then the last set of instructions, the three specific instructions, once we've taken the refuge vow, are, first, respect should be shown for images of the Buddha, whatever they may be, from a small image molded in clay upward to a huge tanka or the Maitreya Buddha statue in the Maitreya Hall at KTC, because they represent the real most precious Buddha. Any representation of the Buddha represents Buddhahood. It represents the ultimate refuge. So we should always show respect for that. Second, respect should be shown for the volumes and collected works of scripture, from a mere letter of scripture upward, to the longest Prajnaparamita Sutra, because they represent the most precious Dharma. So any example of the Dharma, we never, for example, put any Dharma on the floor. Even if somebody gives you like a handout, and of course you run into the Dharma Center in Richmond. Last week I started teaching the 37 practices and I gave everybody a copy of the 37 practices, and a brand new person put hers down on the floor and it just wasn't the moment to say anything. So I'll say it in general terms. I didn't think to say it before I passed it out. But we never put anything in a low place, especially on the floor. Never step over any scripture, any Dharma. And then third, respect should be shown for Buddhist garb, from a simple patch of yellow cloth upward, because it represents the most precious Sangha. So I'm curious what Rinpoche Tukwu says about that one. He says it a little more generally. For the members of the Sangha, that we should show respect for members of the Sangha, monks and nuns, as well as for all representations of the three jewels. So that is the eighth of 9 points. the instructions. And so that's good to review. That's really good to review sometimes. Ringu Tulku's version is perfectly excellent and it's very concise. And then so ninth on page 107, middle of page 107, the benefits. So what are the benefits of taking refuge? You know, we should know those before we take refuge. Why would we take refuge if we don't know the benefits? So we've all taken refuge and we probably did it because we trusted Walman or Rinpoche, for example, to know what to advise us to do. But here are the actual benefits. A person becomes a Buddhist with all the, you know, advantages that come therefrom. It is the basis for all other precepts. Refuge is the basis for all precepts, all other vows. All evils formerly committed will be consumed. I think that's an odd translation, and I did not look up the Tibetan, but I looked it up in the other translation of Jewel Ornament, and that one says purified, which makes a bit more sense to me. But I'm sure Ken had a good reason for saying consumed, probably a literal translation. So once we take the vow of refuge, we have the basis for purifying all negative actions committed in this lifetime and previous lifetimes. Because the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are on our side in this process. Number four, hindrances created. Hindrances are obstacles created by humans or non-humans can no longer overwhelm us. And again, that's like it just by bringing the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha to mind. Like what? It's not ice cream that's going to help us when we're feeling like there's a demon in the room. You know, we really want to go for Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and they can really protect us. Number five, all that is wished for will be achieved. I think that's a really, you know, that's a really motivating benefit. Number six, great causal merit is accrued. And that's in a footnote, an endnote, 153, which is on page 304, if you're looking. And I thought that one was worth reading. So in itself and as the basis for all other precepts, taking refuge is a cause of great merit, since the karmic power of a vow such as refuge acts continuously even in sleep. So this is actually, I think, not that I'm an expert on the various levels of vows, but even just with the refuge vow, that's the benefit of a vow. The Kenjuk, the book where it's Gateway to Knowledge in English. That's the book that explains like the five skandhas and a lot of technical things. And amongst the five skandhas, vows are considered form. It's like considered like a solid thing, a vow that you've taken. So a vow operates, once you've taken the vow, it operates even when you're sleeping, even when you're not conscious. So there's an advantage over simply thinking every time you see a bug, I'm not going to kill that bug. But you get the merit. The merit continues. It continues all the time, even when there's not a bug in front of you, you know, to be protected. So that's great causal merit. And then seventh of eight, the person will not fall into the lower states. And eight, the person will soon become truly and perfectly enlightened. So these are the benefits of taking refuge. So he sums it up. The first point in this overall section on the persons whose lives constitute a basis for bodhicitta, because remember this, the basis is the first of the 12 topics under bodhicitta. Refuge is the basis. That's this chapter. So the first point in this overall chapter on the basis discussed the necessity of having Mahayana potential. The second concerned the need to have taken refuge, as explained above, why we take refuge and who we take refuge in. And the third point deals with the need to have taken one of the pratimoksha commitments, one of the vows of personal or individual liberation. And that's where we are now. And I promised we would talk about that this week because Gampopa says something slightly different from, well, actually significantly different from Ringu Tulku on this topic. So we're not going to read this whole section because I also want to get to the three kayas. But we're going to read some of it. Let me see if I had anything from Ringu Tulku on this. No, I don't think so. No, oh no, I was gonna, I picked up Ringu Tulku because I was gonna look back at the beginning of the chapter, which is page 67, the bottom of the page. So we know that that Gampopa has said that in order to take, in order to engender bodhicitta, you have to truly engender bodhicitta, you have to have taken one of the pratimoksha commitments. And this chapter is going to explain, this section is going to explain what they are. In fact, that's what he says in the last sentence I read. The third point deals with the need to have taken one of the commitments, one of the vows. But what Ringu Tulku says, to review that, he says, in the tradition of Atisha, followed by Gampopa, it is considered that one must have previously taken refuge or one of the Vinaya vows to be capable of developing true bodhicitta. So I'm just going to, we're going to look at this from Gampopa's point of view now, and then we'll have some time to talk about it. So bottom of page 107, individual liberation vows. There are four main types of individual liberation vows, which when considered through the individuals, males and females, they're open to both males and females, who might take them, that makes eight categories. So each of the four can be taken by either a man or a woman. So he's saying that that makes eight categories. Of these, if you disregard the temporary precepts observed when fasting, there are seven. So there's just really just seven vows that we're talking about, seven levels of vows that we're talking about, or seven levels in if you divide male and female into two different levels. And so that's about the sojong vows. It doesn't include, we're not talking about sojong vows here. We're talking about vows that you take basically for life. And sojong vows are only taken for 24 hours. So whichever one of these seven is appropriate is adopted. The seven classes of individual liberation commitment are those of the monk, the nun, the novice monk, the trainee nun, the novice nun. So there's three levels for women and two levels for men that are ordination vows. And then there's the lay vows for men and the lay vows for women. And they're the same vows. Well, the lay vows are the same for men and women. I think there are, I guess it is different. There's different commitments if you're a man or a woman when you take monk and nun vows. So the bodhisattva level says of these, oh, I said to skip that. So let's skip down to the next paragraph. Now one might ask, why is it that one needs to have vows as a prerequisite for generating engaged bodhicitta? They should understand this need for such vows as a basis for engaged bodhicitta in three ways, by simile, by scriptural authority, and by reason. So we've seen that we need three, you know, these three different kinds of support for any, it seems for any sort of statement. So the first way is by simile, and I thought this was quite interesting, by analogy. A place to which a great universal monarch is invited to come and stay should not be filled with impurities such as dung and rubbish. It should be an excellent dwelling place, spotlessly clean, and decorated with many fine adornments made of precious substances and the like. It should be a pleasing place. Likewise, when someone is cultivating the great monarch bodhicitta and hoping for it to remain, the place where it can abide is not in a person who is not committed to avoiding wrong physical, verbal, and mental actions. It is not in one who is tarnished by the stains of evil. It is to be invited to reside in someone without the stains of physical, verbal, and mental evil, someone whose physical existence is properly adorned with the moral discipline of commitment. And I just want to say, in case I didn't say it already, we're not saying everybody has to take vows. But there are vows available to, you know, people who want to take ordination, as well as to any lay person who wants to take any level of vows, there's five lay vows, and you can take even just one of them. And we'll talk more about that in a bit. So that's the similes that you just want, you want to make the vessel. If you take the bodhisattva vow, you become a vessel for the bodhisattva vow, and you want to be as clean and pure a vessel as possible, which means having renunciation, basically. Having renunciation for believing that you will find happiness in samsara, because that's what at least the vows I'm familiar with are about, is about renouncing that belief. like really believing that there's no happiness in samsara, so you don't have to engage in negative actions for your own, you know, supposed happiness and well-being at the expense of others. All right. So that's analogy. You just want to make your vessel as appropriate as possible. The second way is by scriptural authority. In the Bodhicitta section of the Ornament of Mahayana Sutras, it says its basis is extensive vows. So the temporary lay vows, that's the Sojong vow, are of limited extent because they only last for a day and a night. Unlike this, the other seven classes are extensive commitments, and this is why those seven are taught as constituting the foundation for bodhicitta. So you need vows that you're basically taking for life. This is explained as meaning that you should observe whichever one of those seven types is appropriate. That's from the quote, which I didn't read. But you get to pick which level of vows you want to take. So we have analogy and we have scripture. And now the third kind of support for this is logical necessity or reasoning, as it says in Jewel Ornament. Through the individual liberation vows, you abandon harm to others. And I find this a really compelling argument, actually. Through the vows, you abandon harm to others along with its basis. Through the bodhisattva vows, you benefit others. So the ordination vows and the lay vows are about giving up harming others in various ways for your own pleasure. And through the bodhisattva vows, you are moving to the next level of wishing to benefit others, of vowing to benefit others. So Gampopa says there is no way in which you can benefit others without first renouncing harming them. But then he goes on to say, and we're not going to go into this at all because it's a cultural thing. We can't even relate to the reasons. But according to some people, the Pratimoksha or individual liberation vows are not necessarily a prerequisite for giving rise to the bodhisattva vow. So there is an out. It's not 100% here. Let me see where I needed to go next. I think that's all we're doing from this section. I just wanted to say before I open it up for any questions and comments. So as lay people, let's just say we're talking about the lay vows. You know, we're not interested in taking ordination. Jinzang accepted because she did take ordination many years ago, but the rest of us have not. The lay vows are five, and that's not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, not to engage in sexual misconduct, which we have previously defined as sexual conduct that harms another person in any way whatsoever. And then the fifth one is no intoxicants. We forswear taking intoxicants. And so many of us who have been in the Dharma for a long time have had the opportunity to take those vows. And some people take all five vows and some people take selective vows because they feel, for example, that they can't give up. Usually it's intoxicants. Usually that's the one that people can't take. So I just wanted to say about this, like it's completely up to the individual whether they want to take any vows at all. Rinpoche Tulku says refuge is fine. But if you decide to take the lay vows, if you have that opportunity, you know, it's just, again, it's like, oh, actually I was going to read something and it's in my notes for last class. I was going to read something from Single Sufficient Virtue about the importance of renunciation, which here is called, this is, I think, Yeshe Jamtso's translation. Let's see. About renunciation, the importance of renunciation, which he calls definitive resolve or definitive resolution. So that's, again, so we're going to talk about renunciation a little bit for a minute. It's this word in Tibetan, Nyenjung, has been translated for many years as renunciation. And it sounds like something you don't want to do. you know, to give up everything. And then it's explained as you don't have to give up everything. You just give up believing that it will lead you to lasting happiness. But it's not a really good translation, it turns out. I think we were just trying to take it from other religions that are, you know, practiced here. And what it really means, it means definite emergence. And I think definite resolution or definite resolve is a really, really good translation of it, because what it means is that you decide that you're not going to find happiness in samsara. You're definitely going to get out of samsara. You're going to liberate yourself from samsara by not looking for happiness in samsara. So what Kala Rinpoche says about this on page 10 of Single Sufficient Virtue, which is a lovely little book, he says, as long as we don't come to some definitive resolution about what we are doing, where we are headed, and what we are trying to do, then we remain in a state of delusion and denial. We remain in delusion about samsara and in denial about the fact that there's no real permanent happiness within it. It's only once we have taken to heart the fact that there is no true, perfect, permanent happiness in samsara that we can actually begin to practice dharma. Because if we attempt to practice dharma, even for years and years, without this resolution as a starting point, then all of our dharma practice will only increase our arrogance, jealousy, and competitiveness, increase our kleshas, mental afflictions, increase our selfishness, and so forth. Therefore, Kala Rinpoche writes, so that was actually Kenpo Kattar's commentary. Now he's going to quote Kala Rinpoche saying, if you don't actually gain decisive resolution about this through contemplating the four thoughts that turn the mind, if you don't turn your mind away from this delusion and denial about samsara, then all of your dharma practice and meditation won't really matter, because your craving for and fixation on samsara will just increase. Your state of mind, it gets grim. Your state of mind, your personality, and your behavior will just get worse and worse. You'll become tougher, harder, and more rigid instead of less so. Therefore, this is the ground for all of our practice, and it is indispensable. Nothing else that we do will actually work if this ground of giving up, seeking happiness and samsara, if this ground is not present, then our dharma practice is ultimately for naught. So that's pretty, definite. So how does this relate to the vows? Well, you know, everybody relates it in their own personal way. I'm just going to speak for myself. Like when I started to like think about this, if you feel that you can't take all of these five vows, not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, not to engage in sexual misconduct and or harmful sexual practices, whatever, and not to take intoxicants, then all of these things, the Buddha made them vows here. They are vows here because they're all things that dig us deeper into samsara. They're all things that increase our involvement in samsara. So if we can't commit to giving them all up, then I think we still have to work on our renunciation or our definite resolve, because we're still believing. If we can't take, for example, we can't give up intoxicants, you know, what are the reasons? Maybe there's social reasons. I can't say what anybody's reasons are, but if we can't give up intoxicants, what does that say about our belief in happiness and samsara? So that's for everybody to work out on their own. It's not for me to say. But I think it's a really interesting question, and it's really interesting to examine this this teaching by Gampopa. So anybody have anything to say about it? Any questions, any comments? Okay, John, I'm going to unmute you, and then Patrick, I think. Okay, John.
Okay, so I've taken the refuge vow way back, like 30 years ago. So to remember that, I just don't remember taking a vow, one of these vows. That wasn't until the Bodhisattva vow that I was asked to do these precepts or other vows. So am I misremembering, do you think, or is there...
Yeah. So you're saying, that when you took the Bodhisattva vow, you were then offered the five lay vows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So Yeah, if they're not often offered. I mean, you can ask for them. If you have a teacher, you can ask for them. I had them from Kala Rinpoche, and I've had them a couple of times from Lama Norla Rinpoche. You take them when you go into three-year retreat. They're like a basis for a three-year retreat. You can't do retreat without taking all five vows.
They're listed here under refuge, though, right? Not bodhisattva.
Right, because we're talking about the basis for bodhicitta, for engendering bodhicitta. This refuge is the basis. And Gampopa says that the basis for bodhicitta is fourfold. You have to be Mahayana, a Mahayana family. You have to take refuge. You have to hold at least one level of vows, and you have to have the aspiration.
Okay.
Mom has something to say, so I'm going to turn it over to her.
I took refuge vows with Kala Rinpoche in 86, and I know that Rinpoche's always offered them, and Lama Norla Rinpoche, and then like before certain empowerments are required that you take refuge. I've personally never actually heard that you had to take one of the lay vows in order to take refuge. This is actually the first time.
Oh no, it's not in order to take refuge. It's in order to engender bodhicitta, to fully engender bodhicitta.
Oh, well, I actually not, I guess, okay.
And it's not, when I've taken the bodhisattva vow, and it's hard to get the bodhisattva vow.
Very hard, because it's hard to set up.
Well, it's hard to set up, but it's also, Rinpoche always explained that it's a very serious vow. Yeah. And you have to be like a really serious practitioner to take the bodhisattva vow. But when he's given the bodhisattva vow, I don't recall that he ever made it a requirement that you take lay vows. That's just offered separately.
So I agree. I don't think anybody
should be encouraged by this if you don't hold lay vows. It's just, I think it's worth exploring, because these vows, what did Gampopa just tell us? Or actually, it was Ken telling us this in a footnote, that when you take vows, the merit from your vow operates even in your sleep, as opposed to being situation dependent. Yes, go ahead.
And also, many years ago, I was in a group interview with Kala Rinpoche. This was way back in India, when several people were taking novice vows. And so that's monastic vows, but they're considered novice. They're not the full thing. And Kala Rinpoche explained it as, he said, you know, ordinary people, like lay folks, anybody can attain enlightenment, but if you take vows, you can think of it as if finding an oasis on a desert. It just makes it easier, because it cuts out certain temptations that might again distract you. And basically, it's also been said that the vows themselves are for the least, you know, when it talks about the three levels of ability or capability, it's often taught that the, you know, those with the least capability are the ones that take the vows, because they don't have within them the kind of diligence to maintain that kind of activity without being encouraged by the vows. And it's very important to understand that the intoxicant vow is one that, the point of that one is that it really is that once you take intoxicants, you're much more likely to act inappropriately with body, speech, and mind. I mean, that's the concept. So it doesn't deal with medical or issues that deal with medicines for mental, issues. It's dealing specifically with intoxicants. Yeah.
That's right.
Anyway, that's all.
Yeah. I just wanted, Patrick, I'm gonna unmute you. And then I wanted to tell the story of the monk and the goat, the woman and the beer. Patrick.
I'll keep it short.
Oh no, it's okay. You don't have to. We're not pressed for time. We're good.
Who's allowed to give these vows at the different levels and refuge?
Lama is at KTC now it would be Lama Norjal, or maybe Lama Tsering. I don't know. I couldn't give them, for example.
I mean, refuge also.
Oh, refuge. Well, generally the advice is that you go to the sort of most realized Lama that you have access to. We have Mingyur Rinpoche coming if anybody doesn't have refuge.
But, I was thinking of somebody who's at death's door or can't travel or that kind of thing, you know, where would they?
Lamanurla Rinpoche gave us permission. We can give refuge, but, you know.
Did you do it on the phone?
Yeah, you can. I have given refuge over, like, Zoom.
Like Zoom?
Yeah, I have.
Thank you.
For somebody who really can't get somewhere, yeah. Yes, we don't deny refuge to anybody. We'll make it happen. But, like, they didn't have that possibility in, you know, cultures before ours. Okay, Deidre.
You know, like you're all in or you're not in at all is I think a little bit tough. And, you know, it's like saying, okay, if you're not renouncing samsara, then all your dharma practice is for naught. To me, that's a little hard line. And hard for me to believe that the Buddha would say that, because sometimes just practicing dharma, it gets you there. It's chicken or egg kind of thing. And I, you know, when some of the lamas are a little tough about it, it can actually turn people off, turn them away from their practice, as I have seen, you know, in the last few months with people who saw Kala Rinpoche and were disturbed.
Hmm.
Yeah, because they felt they felt he was, you know, like saying that they were, that all their practice was for nothing if they weren't doing it 1,000%.
Well, they always say, they always speak in hyperbole, and I think we have to understand that.
Yeah, I think some, but I don't think some people do, and so I'm just saying, you know, I think that, you know, we have to be, when reading these things, even like you just did, is that hyperbole? Or are we supposed to take that as, you know, gospel truth?
Well, let's go back to the first verse of 37 practices.
I mean, just from what you said today, like if you are not renouncing samsara 100%, then your practice is...
That was Kala Rinpoche. That was the old Kala Rinpoche. And again, he's speaking to, you know, Tibetans of a different generation than ours. Well, I mean, teachers don't teach that way right now, generally. Mm-hmm. And we've seen, like in the Torch of Certainty, there's a lot of statements like the different ways that you can die. I mean, there's so many things that are cultural in there. They're for a different time and sort of mentality. Mm-hmm. So I hear what you're saying, and I agree with it. And Tibetan teachers, like even the, you know, the older generation, they've really toned down. They don't teach the hell realms anymore. I haven't heard anybody teach the hell realms in a really long time.
Yeah.
So we have to soften it up, I think, and take our culture into account. But we also have the protector deities, right? I mean, there's the different presentations for the different propensities of people. And so where somebody might be turned off by a really strong way of saying something, another person might really take it to heart because of that. When you're talking to a lot of people at the same time, you may not be able to say it in a way that addresses each one of them individually at exactly their level. I'm not disagreeing with you at all, but I think there is a reason that these things were expressed the way that they were, and we have to figure out how to interpret them for our situation.
Mm-hmm.
We can't, like, make the Torch of Certainty be written differently or Kala Rinpoche's, you know, practice be written differently, but we have to interpret it. And so that was the reason for my wanting to discuss it now, is that this is what Gampopa said. How does this affect us? How does this ring true for us? Does this discourage us? And he's not saying, I don't think he's saying you can't develop bodhicitta. He's saying that you can't fully develop bodhicitta unless, and so it's not, I don't think it's even a question of formally having the vow as it is formally having that level of renunciation. Like,
yeah, that's what I'm saying, because you say if without this renunciation, all of your dharma practice is just going to make your ego bigger and make you more attached to life and everything like that. But
do you think that's not true? I mean, do we think that's not actually true?
I do, because I think you can start off not renouncing, but I think after dharma practice, you can become that. You know, it's I think it's chicken or egg kind of thing, you know, which came first. And I know that, you know, practice gets deeper the more you practice. So you can't start off, you know, it's like Rinpoche said, we're like the bug in a jar. We climb up, have some little realization, and then fall down again, and then climb up again.
Yeah.
So I don't see it as a straight line.
No, I agree. I think it's a process, and I think we can disregard like the term in which this is put and really says that I really need renunciation if my Dharma practice is going to be effective. I think he does say it in a hyperbolic way for whatever reason he says it that way. But it gives me pause. Like, let me check in with my renunciation. Like, am I still looking to samsara for refuge? Which I think is what that's about, is renunciation is about not looking to samsara for refuge anymore. It's not, the ice cream is just not going to save you or whatever. But I'm going to unmute Dave, who's been waiting for a while. Mm-hmm. And if you want to say anything further, Dater, just let me know. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, two things. The first was on the vows, I can't remember where I've read it, but on the intoxication vow, not only do you have that, the propensity for breaking other, you know, bad behavior, but also there was something where you're not relying anymore on a substance that can alter your state of consciousness and have that, you know, be a refuge. So it's like whatever state of consciousness you're in and, you know, whatever meds you need, that's one thing. But taking relief from, you know, getting high or drinking or something, you just kind of agree that's not going to help you. And it's actually going to probably harm you, because if you had a troubled state of consciousness to start with, now you're just going to do this for a while and be right back where you were later. So that's one point that I heard that may be wrong or maybe right. And another thing with the renunciation, just like Deja said, I found that has been a problem for me for many years. And like, I think that there were a number of years I didn't practice because of a bad interpretation of that. Like, oh, I can't get here because I'm doing certain things that I can't stop. And so therefore, what's the point? And I think from looking at the 12 links recently, and also the beginning of the Gampopo, when he's laying out, the nature of samsara is, you know, the suffering and its emptiness, and the nature of nirvana is not suffering and its emptiness, is kind of like, and like your ice cream example, say, so renouncing it wouldn't mean you don't eat the ice cream. And even if you eat it to excess and you're caught up in it, you know, that happened and you don't like it, you know, so you may go through it and it still happens, but you're not saying, hey, all I need to do is get more ice cream. You know, you're just saying when you can get to where you're no longer in that link and you're coming back around for a second pass, that, hey, I would prefer not to do that.
Yeah. So take a vow not to eat ice cream.
Yeah, it's not like
never eat ice cream again.
Yeah, it's not like you can't, like, because that's a very slippery slope. If you're depressed and you're trying to use this stuff to help the causes of depression, and you know you can't do certain things, you know, if it's all or nothing, we're all screwed, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think these are aspirations. Right. And I think it's also important to remember that Gampopa, and probably Kala Rinpoche too, when he wrote this, are talking to monastics. Mm. They're not talking to lay people. They're not really talking about lay vows, because they're talking to monastics. And so monastics, to be monastics, they already have to have taken these vows. And the vows, I think you made a really good case for the vows being a support, you know, to stay away from behaviors that probably are going to get you into trouble. It's very hard to, you know, it's a very slippery slope, as you said, whether you have one serving of ice cream or two servings of ice cream or, and so on and so forth. I'm going to need to stop the discussion. I'm going to recognize Lama Jinzong, but we need to stop so we can cover the three kayas briefly. Yeah, Lama Jinzong.
Just really in brief, I know that over the years, Lama Nyala Rinpoche again and again really tried to clarify what renunciation meant, because that's exactly it. It's a big turnoff. Like, do I give up my family? And if I'm not giving up my family and my interests, and it was like, no, no, you're just giving up the concept that whatever appears is actually existent in the way that it appears. It's that simple, you know. But then just speaking to this, like, I also have a problem with the hyperbole of the benefits, you know, that all that is wished for will be achieved. And like Lama Nyala Rinpoche always said, remember, what all that is wished for has to be in accord with the Dharma. Right. So there's certain commentary that's left out. And also just the idea that, you know, the person will not fall into lower realms. Well, there's still karma involved. You know, you can't just take refuge once. It really means that you're holding the vows perfectly. So, you know, to me, this is all like why Lama Nyala was always like, you just do your best.
Do your best. You make your decisions based on where you are right now. You do your best. I think Deirdre made a really excellent point. It's hyperbole. It seems like it's hyperbole to say that all of your Dharma practice is for nothing and will only make you worse. I think that's the whip thing, which apparently worked really well on Tibetans, especially Tibetan monastics. You know, for us, Lama Nyala Rinpoche also said many times, and this was later in his life, but I heard him say many times, that whatever Dharma practice you've done in your life, even if you never do any more, even if you stop completely, it's going to be there for you in adversity. And when you die, it's never lost. So that would seem to, you know, contradict, you know, that's the thing about at least Vajrayana Buddhism. It's so full of contradiction, you know, in one text or in one paragraph, it says this. And in the next chapter, it says that, or we have Ringu Tulku, you know, saying something really different from Gampopa here. We can go with the Ringu Tulku. You need refuge or a vow to really engender bodhicitta. And that means everybody who has refuge. And what if you don't have refuge, but you're a sincere practitioner, you haven't had a chance to take refuge? I don't think that's lost either. But I think we have to remember they're talking to very specific audiences in very specific times, and we have to do a little bit of translation. But it's also worth thinking about the meaning of it, like that renunciation or, you know, definite resolve is that important. And if you have a reason to not take any particular lay vow, that's something to examine. Like, what does it mean that I'm hesitant to take this vow? Not, the other one that people don't take quite frequently is the sexual misconduct one. It's like, okay, what sexual conduct do I think the vow would prevent me from engaging in that I feel I must engage in? Let's see, conduct that doesn't harm people. You know, we're so afraid to cut off any option in our culture. We want to keep all of our options open. But anyway, it's all just something to consider. We're looking at a 12th century teacher talking to monastics here, but I still think there's food for thought, and I really appreciate the discussion from everybody. I'm gonna read the, we're gonna turn to Ringu Tulku now, page 72, and sort of zip through the three kayas. This is not in this chapter of Gampopa. He does not talk about the three kayas he refers to them a couple of times, but he doesn't really talk about them until chapter 20, which is the result, like what's it like to be a Buddha. And that's where he explains the three kayas. But here, Ringu Tulku obviously thinks that it's beneficial for us to understand a little bit of what the Buddha is, like what Buddhahood is, and that's the three kayas. So if you have not encountered teachings on the three kayas or the three bodies of a Buddha before, and it seems incomprehensible, although I don't think Ringu Tulku's explanation is pretty accessible, but they're still very difficult concepts. So don't be discouraged if it doesn't quite make sense, because you'll get more teachings on it and it will make more sense as you go along the path. So page 72, now having, you know, taken the Buddha as our ultimate refuge, now we should of course have an idea what a Buddha is, since there is no meaning in wanting to become something we know nothing about. In a general way, as previously stated, and this also is important, we can define a Buddha as a being who has developed his or her wisdom and compassion to the utmost, the most important working definition of Buddha. complete development of wisdom, complete development of compassion. That's what we're working on. Like, that's the path. However, there's no simple definition of what a Buddha is, and therefore we have to approach his nature from different angles, his or her nature. Actually, there's no his or her, I think, once you're Buddha. A Buddha is thus described as possessing three kayas or bodies. That's the literal translation of kaya, which are the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, and the Nirmanakaya. This notion isn't always very well understood, even by people who've been studying it a long time. It doesn't mean that the Buddha has different forms, but that what we call Buddha can be described from three angles, three aspects, or three points of view, only one of which involves an actual body like Shakyamuni Buddha. That's just one aspect, one of the three aspects. So first, the Dharmakaya. The Dharmakaya indicates, The Dharmakaya indicates the absence of dualistic thought of the type, this is me and these are others. This is good and this is bad. A Buddha is free of such concepts because he or she has perfectly realized emptiness. Some people think that the absence of dualistic perception implies that all distinction between self and others disappears. And this is an important point too, because this is a misconception that many people have, and that one is then reduced to nothingness, as if one were atomized or had sunk into a deep coma. They then wonder what could possibly be desirable about such a state and come to the conclusion that it's preferable to abandon all spiritual practice and content oneself with pursuing worldly pleasures. They forget that this is not the only aspect that characterizes a Buddha. So what does the emptiness aspect mean? The Dharmakaya is the Buddha's mind. Of the three aspects, this represents the Buddha's mind. It is completely free from any delusion. So it is free from concepts, assumptions, grasping, doubts, and fear. What would that feel like if we were free from all of our opinions? Like, just for a moment, what would it feel like to be free of opinions, concepts, assumptions, grasping, doubts, and fear? It is a limitless, boundless, clear, and direct awareness. The thinking mind that we experience is unclear and full of assumptions and inferences, and, you know, things we need to say on Facebook. The mind of Dharmakaya transcends that and sees directly and clearly, hence there is no need to have concepts or assumptions. This is the deepest experience of the true nature of our mind. The Buddha's mind is omniscient because it is not fettered with dualistic thoughts. This experience is also called Rigpa. We encountered that in verse 3 of the 37 practices. Called Rigpa, Mahamudra, clear light, and great perfection. Like space, it is limitless, uncompounded, not made of different things, unable to be grasped and identified in any way. This is actually a very profound teaching about the nature of mind, which Dharmakaya is like the full realization of nature of mind and abiding in that. It is always there, but you cannot capture it. It is peaceful. Nothing can disturb it. It is clear. Everything is seen unobstructedly. It is compassionate. All beings are seen as equal to oneself. It is powerful. A Dharmakaya being can emanate and arise as anything or anybody as is needed with no effort. This is the essential nature of all of our minds. So Dharmakaya is the mind aspect of the Buddha. No conceptuality, no physicality involved. The Sambhogakaya is the way Buddhas see themselves. I love that line. I mean, I can't really relate to it, not being there, but the way Buddhas see themselves as the radiance of the five wisdoms, ever pure, as it can never be defiled, ever youthful, as it is beyond birth, death, and change. The literary translation of Sambhogakaya is body of enjoyment. And so I don't think he says it here, but that's like when we visualize Chenrezig. That's the Dharmakaya. That's the body of light, you know, very colorful, ornate, always youthful, always radiant, doesn't get old, doesn't get sick. So it's sort of the first level of physicality, but it's not like solid physicality, like having a physical body. So if the Dharmakaya is the complete and total realization of what we call Buddha mind in its original pure state, free of all duality and negative emotion, the Sambhogakaya is the presence of different aspects of wisdom. So it's not an, Buddha's not an emptiness. Like Dharmakaya is the emptiness aspect, but then Sambhogakaya brings in the wisdom aspect. Sambhogakaya is the presence of different aspects of wisdom. Buddha nature is not a dull state comparable to deep sleep. On the contrary, it is alive with vibrant and powerful energies, what we call the five wisdoms. To explain it very briefly, and this is very profound as well, the five negative emotions, anger, desire, pride, jealousy, and ignorance, can be transformed into the five corresponding wisdoms. Buddha nature, far from being an empty void or just clear awareness, also possesses these energies, these wisdoms. I know Patrick is enjoying the word energies here. This is why the Sambhogakaya forms of the Buddhas are always represented in Tibetan religious art as young and beautiful princes or princesses or deities adorned with jewels and magnificent ornaments, symbolizing the vivacity, the shining radiance of this aspect of Buddhahood. So this is a dynamic aspect of Buddhahood. It's a very rich aspect. Which brings us to the Nirmanakaya, the third aspect of Buddhahood or dimension of Buddhahood. The third aspect is the Nirmanakaya, which is what is seen by others. So Sambhogakaya is the way Buddhists see themselves. And only highly realized bodhisattvas are said to be able to actually see Dharmakaya manifestations. Nirmanakaya is what everybody sees. Like the Buddha Shakyamuni walked through the world and met people, and people became his followers. They could see him. When one becomes a Buddha, one doesn't disappear from this world like a blown out candle flame. The flow, the continuity of the Buddha emanations remains and never stops. Just as we experience this life and a succession of rebirths within samsara, when one becomes completely enlightened, Buddha mind continues to manifest in all the forms that are necessary and useful for the benefit of beings. A Buddha can not only manifest in the Sambhogakaya form, but Buddhas can also manifest in physical form as physical people, like the Shakyamuni Buddha, as physical objects. They're said to be able to, if you need a bridge will appear. Buddha could be a bridge for you. A Buddha no longer has any limited or egotistical thoughts. He or she can manifest innumerable emanations without being restricted by space, time, variety, or number. These manifestations are what we call the Nirmanakaya. So he sums it up by saying, the three kayas are one way of describing and understanding the qualities of a Buddha. All three aspects are present at the same time. So when the Buddha appeared, when Shakyamuni Buddha appeared in his physical form, he also was the Sambhogakaya, his energy, wisdom aspect, and the Dharmakaya, his emptiness, ground of all possibility aspect. All three aspects are present at the same time. A Buddha's mind is absolutely clear and aware, and therefore does not need to make any assumptions and concepts because all is perceived directly. This reminds me actually of a lovely quote from Mingyur Rinpoche, which you've probably seen if you're taking any of Mingyur Rinpoche's classes, that if we could see, if we could see the sort of ultimate reality of any situation, our only response would be compassion. The Buddha sees everything and he has only compassion. It sees the enlightened as well as the unenlightened aspects and can manifest in whatever way that might help beings. And there'll be more on this in chapter 20. So here's the really important thing. The three kayas are also the inherent nature of our own mind. We already possess the three kayas, but because we don't recognize our Buddha nature, we don't see ourselves that way. When we realize them experientially, that is enlightenment. So the three kayas are another way of describing awakening or enlightenment, and we possess them just as we possess Buddha nature or Buddha potential. We possess the three kayas already, and we can learn to recognize them through our practice. So I did want to go back to, before we close, back to refuge, page 71, bottom of page 71. I think I read this paragraph last week right at the end. I'm going to read it again. We find a purpose by going for refuge to the Buddha. We find a way by going refuge to the Dharma. And we create the right circumstances for our practice by going for refuge to the Sangha. Taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is practicing the spiritual path or the path to Buddhahood. Name of the book. All right. So anybody have a parting comment? We have like 1 minute left and we will do our prayers. Yes, Lama Jinzong, you are unmuted.
Well, one thing I just wanted to give a very brief quote. I have a note for Lama Denis Rinpoche that was beautiful, but then very brief. But then I also just wanted to give the page numbers for next week so that.
Oh, great. Great.
But so Lama Denis, you know, because when they talk about the wisdom, having five wisdoms and always conceptually thinking of it as five, he said, it's like white light into a prism. It's diffracted into a spectrum of five colored light, same nature, different aspects. So when it talks about the five wisdoms, think of it as an example of the prism, not actually five different things, only single wisdom, but conceptually described as having these five aspects, which I just thought that was nice, like a prism diffracting.
Yes, lovely. Thank you. And Mark has his hand raised. So I'm unmuting you, Mark.
Thank you. I'll just like to say that I agree with this whole, the idea that a lot of this stuff is fairly old, you know, being taught for the benefit of monastics. Mm-hmm. And that I was going to have a question that also is there actually a group or a recognized group or a recognized, you know, bunch of teachers who are trying to make this, take it out of that realm and put it in the realm of, you know, the life that we're living in this age?
Oh, I think everybody's working on that. I think Lama Norla Rinpoche worked on that. You know, he came from being completely immersed in this Tibetan monastic culture. And over the decades, the 4 decades that he taught here, his style of teaching and what he said changed like tremendously. Yeah. Mingyur Rinpoche, I would say, any of the younger lamas, Mingyur Rinpoche, Kala Rinpoche, the young Kala Rinpoche, he probably, I mean, it seems like maybe he has put things in a really strong way that Deidre was present for. But I found him also very forgiving and very much speaking to our culture when he was at KTC. So I think they're all working on that frontier, but there is this danger. I mean, there are people also who feel like we should just throw out the whole thing. Don't read those old texts. Yeah. Let's recreate it in our, you know, as something that really speaks to our culture. But the danger is that you throw out the baby with the bathwater. So I think it's been a very cautious and slow process, frustratingly so for some people. But I think everybody's working on that frontier. We have a lot of, you know, Dzongsar Chensei Rinpoche, who made movies. I've got a couple of people who had something to say first. Oh, sorry, Mark. Yeah, did you have something else?
Rinpoche, Dzongsar Chensei, I think is his name.
Yeah.
Movies, yeah. Yeah, he's one of those guys. But yeah, so much amazing wisdom in these teachings.
Say that again?
There is so much amazing wisdom in these teachings. It would be a shame if they got lost either because they were too, you know, hardliner for people to take or too loose in the other direction.
Well, I think that's what we have is we have a lot of realized teachers who are trying to, you know, figure out how to interpret that for our culture without losing it. I mean, that's why I teach these texts because they do speak, I think, to our culture, but there are things that need to be talked about as we talked about it today. So I'm going to unmute Lama Jinzong and then Kathy Rogers. Oh, sorry, I think I muted you.
Okay. Well, you would certainly include Ringo Toku in this.
That's Ringo Toku.
I mean, like when we were teaching about the spiritual friend in this text, the very end part of it is him specifically saying that, you know, this idea that you should do everything that the teacher says as that's a sign of devotion. And he's like, no, you really have to think about what they're saying and make a choice, an educated decision based on, you know, your own common sense, et cetera. So, and also even His Holiness Karmapa, when he was teaching the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva, again, he also said, like, what is it that when it talks about a spiritual friend and, you know, you're like, what does it mean to be authentic? And it's saying that it's not about the, you know, it's always taught in the ideal, but ultimately in these days, it's just if you're finding that a teacher has benefited you personally, then that's what is authentic. So I think there's, I mean, all I think everyone's talking in that, you know, talking about what does it mean to say, you know, and like the latest Kala Rinpoche is like, it's not about worship, you know, worship of a teacher. So I haven't heard any teacher not try to bring it into the culture of today.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to unmute Kathy Rogers, and then I think we'll have to do our prayers. Go ahead, Kathy.
Just quickly, every teaching I ever heard from the very first one by the Dalai Lama, at the very beginning of every teaching, he says, whatever you feel that, you know, works for you, keep it. If it doesn't, set it aside. Just, you know, maybe another time it'll mean something, but you can't get everything at one time.
Yeah,
that was always so helpful to me, because I was, you know, I went in and jumped in with both feet into a place I had absolutely no clue what was going on, and that's what I did. And I can look back and see where things started to, you know, where I started to mature spiritually. That was very, very helpful.
Yeah, I think that speaks to Deirdre's concern as well. You know, take what works and don't worry about what doesn't work. Like, just keep doing your best, as Lama Jinsong said. So Lama Jinsong, I'm going to unmute you for the page numbers.
So we begin next week, or probably the next 2 weeks at least, the chapter on the proper adoption of bodhicitta in this book, The Ornament of Precious Liberation. It's a very long chapter. It begins on page 110 and goes all the way to 143.
Okay.
And we're obviously, I'm going to be just taking parts of that. And where it, you know, look through it, I would say that, especially where I'm going to shorten it, is when he goes word for word through the actual ceremonies for generating bodhicitta, of the bodhicitta vow. But so it's that chapter 9. But the pages for Path to Buddhahood, specifically, they bookcase either side of what Lama Chögyam just went through. So in Path to Buddhahood, it starts on page 64, where it says the fourth antidote, bodhicitta. And it goes from 64 to 67, where at the bottom you'll see refuge. That's where Lama Chögyam began. And then we'll pick it up again on page 76, where it says the bodhicitta of commitment. And that ends at page 80. And so we're pretty much going to, that's where he talks about the bodhisattva vows specifically. And so that's going to cover almost 15 pages in the Ornament of Precious Liberation, where he talks about the actual vow itself, describing it in much briefer way. So it's, like I said, 64 to 67, and then 76 to 80 in Path of Buddhahood, and then as much as you'd like to read chapter 9 in this book.
Okay, thank you very much, and I'll send that out in an email as well, but in case I don't get to it right away, you have your page numbers. All right, we're going to do our prayers. Let's take a moment to bring our minds back. Just sorry we have run over today, but I think it was a really valuable discussion, and I appreciate everybody's enthusiasm and contributions. So bringing our minds to rest. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, that's the three Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. Okay, you are all unmuted.
Thank you, Lama Chidrin.
Thank you, Lama Jinzong. Thank you, everybody. Great to see everybody. And.